What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
What came next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. As shared in part one of his story, Matthew Cohn is a business professional and musician from Los Angeles, California. Our personal history begins in the early 2000s when we were connected through mutual friends. At the time, Matt shared very little of his experiences of abuse in the troubled teen industry. In fact, it wasn't until he watched the 2024 Netflix documentary, The Program, Cons, Cults, and Kidnapping, that he truly came to terms with all of the horrors he had seen and faced. Admittedly, it was a validating, eye-opening experience for him to watch. The Broken Cycle Media team is extremely grateful for his candidness today, as well as all of his efforts he's making to change the troubled teen industry.
In the almost 4 years that I was in these programs, I did not go to school. I turned 18 with an eighth grade education. I get out June 2004. I turn 18 and I age out. I'm unceremoniously dumped on a plane back to Los Angeles. There are no resources to get me caught up to speed. It's just, well, here you go, kid. You're 18 now. See ya. I knew that I wanted to hit the ground running. I never wanted to be held back again. My education was a huge part of my healing process. I would not be where I am today had I not pushed through with it. I didn't have a high school education. I spent maybe 7 years taking undergrad courses. I could not stop taking classes. My life in that time was very chaotic. I was sleeping on couches. I figured out a few years ago when I bought a mattress at Costco. That mattress was the first real mattress I had had since I was 14 years old. Because you do not get real mattresses in these programs. And I was in college sleeping on air mattresses. I was bouncing from town to town, college to college. I couldn't stay still. I was transferring a lot. I met all sorts of people. I messed up a lot of relationships. It was very difficult to navigate socially. I think I came across as just a wild man. I was moving too quickly to process or to understand. I was committed to reclaiming what I had lost. One of the main ways I did that was by studying analytic philosophy. I picked it up maybe my third year of college. I started in psychology, and then when I found philosophy, I realized that's what I had been looking for. I dug deep. I read everything I could for as long as I could take classes. Through philosophy, I came to understand how misunderstandings can happen and what I can really expect from other people, what other people are owed of me and what I am owed of them. Philosophy taught me how to think about all these things. In processing all of that, it helped me process my unique experience and how to integrate that into the real world going forward. I finished up with 2 bachelor's degrees, almost 3 majors, 220 undergraduate credit hours. It didn't get hard until my mid to late 20s. Around 25, 26, I started really realizing what I'd lost. And I realized I've lost all of this because of these programs. That's when I started really struggling with the reality of it. It started turning much darker. In the course of my late 20s and 30s, most of the people from my programs who I kept in touch with passed away. It was a lot of drug overdosing, incarceration. One sweet girl fell through the ice on a lake in Colorado chasing her dogs. And you feel all of it. You feel every loss because I've watched it kill my friends. I've watched them die. I love these people. I watch what the chaos of this upbringing does to all of us. You have a trauma bond with these people. These are people you screamed with. You suffered with these people. You were tortured with these people. There's no bond like it. And to watch them pass was devastating. When you have these experiences, it just shunts you onto a different train track, no matter how you look at it. I had a catastrophic breakup at 29. I turned 30, living in New Orleans with a bass guitar, my sweet dog, Jeremy, a suitcase full of clothes, and a Subaru Forester. I didn't really have a friend in the world. I was not in a good place. I didn't feel like there would be anything to look forward to going forward. Really, the majority of my 30s were characterized by digging my heels in for my career and intense loneliness. Spent maybe 6 months after that catastrophic breakup, sleeping on a couch with next to nothing to my name, drinking heavily. I said, wow, I need to get my life together. So I began to prep for the GRE, the graduate school exam. I took it. I did very well, and I was accepted to Tulane for graduate school, which was extremely convenient because I was already living there, and it was the only place I applied to. I completed a year-long Master of Finance. I used that Master of Finance to get into investment banking, worked at a oil and gas investment bank there in New Orleans, and then merged over to an institutional brokerage where I sell stock picks to hedge funds. And I've done that for 4 years now. I've been very successful professionally, and I'm very thankful for the opportunities I've had there. I look at what I've accomplished and I realize that I've had to climb twice as far as most other stockbrokers, investment bankers, or Wall Street guys. I think, how could I ever be ashamed of myself? How could I doubt my strength when so many people failed to get to this point? I got here myself with grit and hard work. For the worst experience of my life, I wouldn't change a thing now. I've seen that I was strong enough to endure it and to take my life to spectacular heights. If you had asked me a year ago if I would change it, I would have said absolutely. The flipping of the switch really came when I saw this documentary, The Program, Cons, Cults, and Kidnapping on Netflix. It immediately put things into perspective for me in a way that I was lacking. the documentary put together by a survivor of a WASP program in New York called the Academy at Ivy Ridge, or AIR. And AIR, like any other WASP program, was a nightmare. So WASP, the Worldwide Association of Specialty Schools and Programs, their programs were brutal. They were absolutely horrific, just about the worst I've ever heard of. They get a lot of the press, people not allowed to talk to one another, people not allowed to look out the window. The food was bad. The abuse was rampant. This documentary was made possible largely because the filmmakers were able to unearth actual footage of restraints and actual notes that detail and corroborate what happened to us. It's the first time where it isn't just our word against theirs. We can point to video footage and say, look how we were being treated. And that's just been very powerful. Everything in that documentary, everything that they say could have come out of my mouth, that hit me like a freight train. I never really understood why I was there. They could never really explain it to me. They told me to work the system, work the program. It was like, fake it till you make it. And teenagers can't fake it till they make it. Teenagers are the most real people there are. It's just an absurd thing to ask them. That was never going to fly for me. That led to its own burden. I spent two decades wondering if I did deserve to be there. But when I watched this documentary, there was a girl who had complied. She was featured in all of AIR's marketing materials. She was the poster child for their program, and she is haunted by that now. And seeing that changed my life overnight. That's when I realized that all of us carry this experience with us moving forward.
I don't see the people who complied in the programs really benefiting from it now. All they learned was how to submit. It took many of them years to figure out how to move past that. It's just really heartbreaking. That was maybe the most eye-opening thing about the documentary for me, seeing that the people who actually worked the program were hurting so badly, made me realize just how bad this whole system is. That documentary hit me like a ton of bricks. I haven't talked to any survivor who it hasn't. The final pieces fell into place. I realized that I didn't deserve any of this. I really had just fallen through the cracks. It's a truth I'd been telling myself for a long time, but nobody's ever really receptive to the conversation. It's been an impossible conversation to have. I could tell myself until I was blue in the face. It was just a very one-sided conversation to have with myself. My birth mom saw the program and is horrified. My adopted mom saw the program and is horrified. I don't think my adopted dad did yet. I don't really speak to my birth father. It's definitely put everyone in a strange place. Wouldn't change it for the world, but I'm hesitant to have some conversations with certain family members. It's just too close to home, and I've worked for a very long time to be distant from all that. Seeing the documentary finally allowed me to accept that, all right, this was a totally screwed up situation that I never should have been in. Realizing that it's still going on, realizing that these kids are still dying, realizing how evil it was, definitely it sent me on a different trajectory than what I had been heading in. The first step was definitely to go back, to revisit these places and to see them, to see what they meant, what they mean to me.
When I was touring these three programs for the first time in 22 years,
I saw them backwards, really. A week after I watched the program, I went to Devereux Clio Wallace, which closed down last year. It was rather eerie. It's a 28-acre campus, and I was able to walk over parts of it that I'd never seen before, like where the two girls' units were. In its own way, it could be a beautiful place. It's right there at the foothill of the Rockies in Colorado, but it's just very eerie. It's so easy to house people there for long term. It's the place I was at the longest, maybe 2.5 years.
I went back to Devereux Clio Wallace with a former staff who had been there when I was there.
It was wonderful to be there with him because he really corroborated a lot of points. A lot of what he said stuck with me. He said that, one, he was shocked by how much medication they were giving us. That's one of the ways they control you, is by over-medicating you so that you just turn into a zombie. I was struck by how effectively they sell a script. Everybody just sticks to their script. He was told that all these kids need is structure, and he believed it.
I asked him at one point what he remembered of me, and he thought about it for a minute. He said, my laughter. And I just think, man, a teenager who people remember as laughter. What was a kid like that ever doing in a place like this? It blows my mind that nobody ever stopped and said, here's a smart kid. He's funny. What's he doing here? Nobody put the brakes on it or questioned the script that they were given at any point. And that's heartbreaking for me. It makes me wonder how many other brilliant kids are just wasting their lives in these places because they're misunderstood with their parents or caregivers.
That was the first one. I went to Clio and was just really struck by it, struck by my conversation with the former staff. Really glad he was there, really glad the other survivors were there. And then I went to Utah afterward.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
The first place I visited in Utah was still open. They expanded from 16 beds to multiple times that. From one single family home to five different large buildings, including a large gym. It's absolutely massive. Seeing youth care open, seeing it having expanded so much was really heartbreaking. They've got large gates up. It's definitely a closed facility. The last place closed down a number of years back. That's Cedar Ridge. They had tried to rebrand, but it was the most obviously abusive of any program that I was in. I drove for maybe 2 to 2.5 hours out to the middle of the Utah desert and just walked around. It's all falling apart. All the domes that the kids made are all falling apart. I saw the old compost heap. I took pictures of the old isolation dome and the little room where I slept on the floor. And then I walked out because it gave me the willies. It was shocking how much the pictures that I took affected our community. Kind of small community of Cedar Ridge survivors, and everybody saw it and just brought up a lot. So that was hard. But seeing all three of the places really helped me put things in place, helped me accept where I was going with what I knew and what I had experienced. So overall, a very positive experience to go back. I still don't know how to do anything other than to run straight at it and hit it on the chin as hard as I can. It's just the nature of my life. Being able to go back to these places, especially Clio and Cedar Ridge, to see those two having fallen apart and to realize that these institutions can fall apart, that they can be destroyed, it's very powerful. When I was in Utah, I spent a lot of time with several survivors and ex-Mormons. That was very gratifying. There's a survivor out there who works as a professor. She's been leading advocacy efforts in Utah for a good little while now. Seeing how dedicated we are to carrying this fight, I think, has been one of the more powerful lessons from the community. I couldn't have avoided coming in contact with the community of survivors after watching that documentary. I saw it and I immediately knew that I needed to meet the other people. I knew that there were other people who understood what I had gone through. So I connected with communities on Reddit and on Facebook. I've just been getting to know them. There's just a lot of beautiful people. This was a very isolating experience, and now it's bringing us together in a really beautiful way. They've become, in a large way, my family. Every year I throw a party for my closest friends. This year, we went to Catalina Island off the coast of Los Angeles. There were a couple survivors there, but what's interesting is I discovered that one of my relatives is a survivor as well. She watched the program and she had been through one of these institutions as well. So it's connecting me in profound ways to people. Getting connected with this group has transported me from feeling very isolated because of this experience to realizing that there are resources available. So I'm very thankful for that.
The community really has been what has started to make the experience be okay for me. The two best resources, I think, are Reddit and Facebook. I'm not a big Facebooker, but it's great for this. There are a number of groups on Facebook, TTI survivors. If you're a survivor of the WASP programs, there are many, 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 many Facebook groups dedicated to them. What a lot of the non-WASP kids, I say kids loosely, I'm a program kid. A lot of what the non-WASP program kids don't realize is that there are resources for them too. My first program, Cedar Ridge, we've got a strong community on Facebook and on WhatsApp. There are Discord channels. All of us communicate. We get together for barbecues. It is very family oriented. There are people who I talk to almost every day. It's a very close-knit community. If you have gone through institutional abuse of any kind and you're struggling with it, I strongly recommend that you reach out to us on any of our forums. There are people who can understand you. Many of us, this might be our primary community outlet and identifying experience. A lot of us had experiences in other institutions where we experienced similar abuse. We're a very inclusive community. We're just here to help people through their trauma, and we're here to understand. One common theme with survivors is we talk about how we were silenced. We've got organizations that are geared around this concept of becoming unsilenced now. Anybody who goes to these programs, we all suffer in very similar ways. We all suffer with anxiety. We've all lost people. We have strange food aversions and food preferences. If you survive, then you discover that you develop some pretty intense preferences. And those preferences extend socially as well. You learn how to choose healthy partners in your teenage years in a lot of ways, and in your 20s. Teenage years and 20s are just a battleground for us. How do you form a healthy relationship afterward if you're coming from that? How do you choose the right person in your 20s if in your teenage years you're used to forming these profound emotional connections with someone who is very physically abusive with you? And if everyone around you says that you are wrong and they are right to do that, how do you do that? That is tough. I don't think anyone ever moves past it entirely. I think that it becomes easier for you to do things in your life. I think it gets easier to move, easier to take action. I was talking about this with a survivor the other day. People think when they watch the documentary or when we share our stories, people think that the restraints and the physical violence was the worst part. And it absolutely was not. The worst part was the isolation, the chaotic relationships, the loss. That was 100% the worst part. That is an underappreciated part of all of this that I'm only just now getting to 20 years later. I didn't know how to communicate or process this experience to myself. It really took 20 years and a documentary for me to understand. I have needed to deprogram. I have needed to understand that what happened to me was wrong, was inappropriate, that it was a cash cow that was making money hand over fist on me. I deserve better. as a human being, as a child.
All of us were made out to be the worst of the worst. It's a moniker that we almost feel is branded on us. If you're 37, 38, you've been out for 20 years, what that means is you've survived and you've spent 2 decades really working hard to show everyone how pleasant you are, because you never want to be mistaken to be a monster ever again. That's pretty uniform for all of us. We're just very kind people. That's why I dig so deeply into the community.
The deprogramming is unpleasant. It definitely involves looking back, staring straight in the eyes, different things that I don't think any of us ever want to think about again. You find yourself always doubting yourself. You really have to catch yourself. You have to be quite vigilant. Even now, I'll think, did I deserve it? In a flash. And I have to pull myself back and say, no child deserves that. You say that 1,000,000 times a day. It's a heartbreaking process. Wouldn't wish it on anyone. I described this experience recently as Conan the Barbarian's Wheel of Pain. So at the beginning of Conan the Barbarian, he's taken from his home and he gets attached to this big, stupid wheel out in the desert, and he's just got to push it around for presumably years. Looks like a absolutely nightmarish, miserable experience, but you got a bunch of muscles out of it. So mixed bag. That's how I feel about the program. I wouldn't be who I am today if it wasn't for this terrible experience. I got a great community out of it, and we're very comfortable together. When we're around one another, it feels like coming home to your country after you've been abroad for a very long time. And I was astounded to discover that it feels like that even with survivors of different programs. We, as program survivors, are aware that these programs are killing children. They don't just kill children while kids are in the program. Kids are aging out and struggling so much in real life that they are dying of overdoses. They are dying in prison. They are dying of suicide at tremendous rates.
We're working hard. There's a Senate hearing coming up as well. There's been the years-long investigation. Hopefully the Senate hearing will be good. I'm looking at sending in my testimony, and I know a lot of other people are as well. Many people are trying to get out there. It's a big moment, people finally catching on and really paying attention to all this. The Senate hearing, hopefully, will be a major piece of that puzzle. Youth Care is one of the companies being investigated by the Senate. Hopefully, we'll be able to get somewhere with the Senate investigation and maybe turn the heat up on them.
We're in the early stages. There's a lot of work going on. We're working on passing a bill right now to try and get more information about outcomes. Some of our most important bills right now are to try and just get information. I am working on communicating and liaising with different fragmented groups throughout the community. We are not a single entity. There are many different groups. In terms of the legal stuff, what I'd love to see is residential programs for children abolished. I would love to see a much larger focus on day treatment for kids who are having issues, more resources for the parents.
I don't see us getting rid of residential programs, even though I feel like that's what needs to happen. I feel in some ways people can't imagine a world without institutions like this. I'd really like to see going forward for survivors is more resources to help us get caught up. There's a lot of people struggling with their career. There's a lot of people struggling with their education. These are massive blows. I can't help but feel that if our society is going to put us in a position where we are set so far behind, it would be wonderful to see help with an education, with career skills, with career building, internships. That's one wonderful way that people could get involved if they have the means or the resources to, would be to help survivors obtain that education. Simply put, without legislation and regulation, these facilities will continue to get closed down on a one-by-one basis and then pop up again under a different name. And it's just going to stretch out getting rid of it completely, because people are going to say, how can we fix it? How can we fix it? And they're going to make these little tweaks. They're going to try and improve how much medication the kids can be on, or maybe they'll make it so that they can see the stars at night once a month or something. They'll make little adjustments here and there without realizing that it's the entirety of the system that is so destructive to a person's development. That's my concern.
I'm reading this book right now on the industry called Help at Any Cost, How the Troubled Teen Industry Cons Parents and Hurts Kids. It came out in like the early 2000s. It was one of the first books that really discussed the history of this industry and how destructive it is. It's absolutely a heartbreaking read. But the mother of one of the children who died in the wilderness program, which is one of the kinds of programs that we get sent to, she said something that stuck with me. She said, they promised us tough love, but there was no love. There was only tough. That's the issue. You can't send your child anywhere but a precious few places and expect your child to be loved. My gut tells me that the human cost is too high. It doesn't matter if it saves one or two, it hurts so many people.
They've discovered that a lot of us are furious. They've created thousands of pissed off former children. It's just not a viable business model.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
There are so many threads of strength and resiliency in your story. What else carried you through?
Music. It means a lot to me. I started playing the bass guitar because I had a friend who I had met in preschool. So when I first started playing bass, it was so that I could play with my good friend. But the more I thought about it and the more I played, the more I realized I've always loved the bass. That's why I listened to so much Motown as a young boy. I love making people dance. I like being the connective tissue between the drums and the guitar. I have these huge hands, which are really ineffective at playing many other instruments. So the bass always spoke to me, and it means a lot to me because I've watched myself improve. It's a sign to me that even though the programs held me back, kept me from so much, it doesn't keep me from improving something that I care about now. And that means a great deal to me. I would describe that as one of the more therapeutic practices that I have. So yeah. Bass has definitely meant a lot to me.
I don't go to therapy after years of being abused in the name of therapy. And that isn't to discourage any other people struggling with their own trauma, any other survivors from seeking out therapy if they feel that it would provide them solace. But for me personally, I would need some kind of therapy to go see a therapist. I have an instant visceral reaction to the entire industry, if you will. It generalizes too. It's not just therapists. It's hard to look at anything now and not wonder who's profiting on it. If you were a child who has been sold out, who became just a number for some corporation spreadsheet somewhere, you struggle to really understand or to really believe that anything could be healthy. A lot of us become very disillusioned. It is capitalism at its most brutal. You lose faith in systems
knowing that these places exist, that children go there, that they have been going there, that they will continue going there until people collectively take action against it. The sexual abuse is rampant. The physical abuse is normalized. The verbal and emotional abuse is systemic. It's so utterly destructive to the human soul in its isolation and its dehumanization. It really astounds me it's still around. But if it's going to be existent, then we need people like me, because maybe I'll be able to convince more people that it needs to stop. Maybe I'll be able to help some people who would fail otherwise get to the other side.
Do you have any words of wisdom for someone who either has gone through something similar or even relate to you via another trauma?
What gives me comfort? I know it was a bad experience, but I think a lot about expectations. I think a lot about what I should expect of the world, what I can expect of the world versus what our social bubble tells us to expect. We want to expect iPhones and we want to expect next day delivery, but the world is not just that. We are flying around at unimaginable speeds on a little ball of rock through a vast chasm of darkness. Nothing is guaranteed here. We didn't have to experience the color red or cheeseburgers or heartbreak, but we've got this brief span of time to find our story. And it isn't always pleasant. It isn't always fun. But when you come from one of these programs, when you survive something, it's a part of your story. It's a part of you. It is that thing that makes you strong. It is the reason that you have armor. For many of us, it's the purpose in your life. Even the most horrific things that we go through, really, they're all tolerable because they just become you at the end of the day. If you can get to the other side of hardship, then you know what you're capable of. If you overcome truly horrific things, then there's a certain degree, I believe, you can use these terrible experiences. It doesn't make them less terrible. It just means that it is a paradox. The things that almost destroy us do become a part of us. It does help put us in contact with communities where we love the people we're around. It does give us a sense of self-worth sometimes. I believe in creating myself. I don't believe in taking what I'm given. I don't believe that I am defined by things that I do not choose. I don't define myself by going through these programs. I do define myself as a bassist, as a philosopher, as a stockbroker, as a good man and a good friend. That's how I see myself. I see myself as unstoppable and fearless. I can't imagine going through anything worse than what I've already been through. It's just heartbreaking for all the people who cannot get to that point. That, I would say, is the hardest thing.
What's one thing you wish everyone on the planet knew about the troubled teen industry?
It's not what I want them to know. It's what I want to know. I want to know how it can still be around. I want to know why people are okay sending their children away, and why they are surprised when their children die or their children do not get better. I want to know why so many of us cannot get our lives together afterward. I want to know why this industry ever existed to begin with. I want this terrible industry to go away. And it won't until everybody not only knows, but is morally outraged. The problem is that enough people know at this point. People all over Utah know that these places exist. I want everybody to know, but more than to know, I guess I want everybody to care. I want people to care that America's children are dying in these places.
That's the problem. Everything that people could know is out there. It's a story that's been told time and time again. If you really think about it, these kinds of institutions have been around for a long time. Anybody's read Charles Dickens knows that the orphanage was a terrible place to be. Orphanages might have been the very first troubled teen industry kind of places, which I suppose is the most horrific part about all of it, is that we've known about all of this for so long, and yet there's still really ineffective guardrails. It's just a shocking disregard of human life. It's not the sort of thing that can change without people dedicated to it. What I want people to do is I want them to care. I want them to care about these stories. Stories are powerful. Stories change lives. It's fascinating when we think of the power stories have in our culture. These are stories that shock people. They give people a glimpse of a life that makes them feel. I really believe if our stories mean anything, then we'll be able to improve the world for the kids going forward. And I'm seeing a lot of evidence of that these days. So I'm hopeful. There's a lot of desperate parents out there who are looking for answers. And these are parents who might have sent their kids to a program, but because of media, they're asking the right questions and they're trying to gain insight from the right people. Maybe they're going to find a different way. And that's my hope, the power of the media in changing the world and changing perceptions. If we're going to win this fight, it's going to be because of a documentary, of a community that comes together using social media, and of stories that are told in a variety of media, from books to interviews to podcasts like yours. All of it is used to bring these institutions down.
Thank you for everything you've shared. I am very sorry that I was not a greater resource for you as you were coming out of that. I'm apologetic, but also sympathetic in that sorry. I value the fact that you have returned to my life at a point when I can verbalize that and also offer an ear. Thank you for doing this and illuminating me personally so much, but also the audience. Also for the legal change that you're calling for and that you're working for, all of the efforts you've made. Diving into it personally, that's life-changing. There's ripple effects for that. Thank you very much for bringing so much knowledge to our audience.
Thank you for having me on your show. Happy to help.
In 2008, the United States Government Accountability Office published a report entitled Residential Programs, Selected Cases of Death, Abuse, and Deceptive Marketing. The report, quote, identified thousands of allegations of abuse, some of which resulted in death at residential programs across the country and in American-owned and American-operated facilities abroad. End quote. Despite the validity of the statement, it is believed that concrete statistics of the prevalence of abuse in the industry are impossible to decipher, considering the lack of reporting and a lack of documentation. And although these findings were published more than a decade and a half ago, there is still no federal regulation or oversight of these programs. There are also no consistent regulations among states. According to the American Bar Association website, the troubled teen industry receives, quote, an estimated $23 billion of annual public funds to purportedly treat the behavioral and psychological needs of vulnerable youth, end quote. As the American Bar Association website goes on to explain, as of 2017, 90% of the troubled teen industry revenue comes from Medicaid, Medicare, and approximately 500 additional federal, state, and local programs. In 2014, a survivor-led campaign entitled #BreakingCodeSilence encouraged the testimonies of those abused within the troubled teen industry. If you or someone you know has been a victim of the troubled teen industry, please consider visiting unsilenced.org for more information and resources. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.